Hey guys, happy Monday, and welcome to the home again of Sound Science. And I saw a tweet today that reminded me, kind of a blast from the past, that myself and Gabor Doshi had, I think, one of the best discussions way back in early 21 around the viral origins. And I know recently Japanese papers have been published showing it pretty much certainly came from a lab, and you're allowed to talk about this now. But I just thought, after I saw a tweet today, and I'm going to show it now on the screen, it'd be a great time to look back at that discussion myself and Gabor had. And I think it is almost certainly one of the best layperson understandable discussions around the features of SARS-CoV-2 and why it almost certainly came from a lab. And way back in early 21, I think this one, among others, was censored. But now it's okay to talk about it. We're allowed to talk about it. Isn't that great? So I'm first going to show you from that tweet this paper, which has Ralph Baric back in 2006, clearly calling out the synthetic viral genomics and manipulation of SARS and other viruses. And interestingly, in the paper, he talks all about how you could humanize zoonotic or nature viruses by inserting mutations into virus attachment proteins or constructing chimeric proteins, etc. So it was fascinating that in 2006, they were already publishing on how you could do this. And in the same paper, we see a description of the methods and how a bioterrorist or an academic working with Wuhan could have a scapegoat option and kind of cover their tracks to an extent. But in reality, of course, they couldn't cover their tracks. And the rest of this video covers that. So I'll now show a brief clip of the video of this Baric character back in 2007 describing some of this work that they were doing.
Now, all of these viruses were viable except for the SC16 variant. This actually can't recognize the humanase receptor, so it didn't grow until we made mouse cells that constitutively express the CIVID-ACE2 receptor. And once we did that, this virus could grow well.
So there you have it. They had certain viruses that they created that would not actually reproduce, etc. But then they used mouse lines to bring in the human ACE receptor, and then they got success even with the ones that were challenging. So they were doing this effectively back in 2007. Just one more clip and we get on to the main event.
Interestingly enough, two of these, the GZO2 and the HCSC6103 viruses, actually caused lethal infection in aged animals. They produced an ARDS-like disease. SARS caused ARDS in humans, predominantly in aged populations. That's acute respiratory distress syndrome. It's a clinically devastating end-stage lung disease with about a 50% mortality rate. So these are actually some of the first real good animal models for SARS infection.
So back in 2007, they were successfully making viruses that caused elderly animals, immunocompromised animals, to get severe lung disease. And they were delighted. Remember, that was 2007, folks. They were demonstrating this in animal models. So there's a lot more in this half-hour presentation that would make the hair stand on the back of your head. But we're going to go ahead now and we're going to look at an excerpt from my interview with Gabor Doshi back in early 2021. And as I mentioned, this is kind of timeless and one of the best discussions of the reasons why the virus almost certainly came from laboratory gain of function and actually using humanized mice, just like the last character talked about. So here we go, folks. Enjoy, and please share and comment below with your thoughts on this fascinating arena.
This one jumps out of nowhere, in a sense, and it massively exploits all of those human pathways of modern chronic disease and kind of immunocompromised nature and acceleration of negative effects from viral kind of interactions. It massively exploits that, which is kind of unusual. Coincidence, maybe. But then the virus also, as you said, the furin cleavage site, it's got these very remarkable kind of properties, again, popped out of nowhere, that link very closely to human susceptibility to infection. So, whoa, there's two weird things, you know. And then you start adding on the other aspects of what you said. And it's almost like, you know, all of this happening seems so curious or unusual. But we might get into, and we'll circle back to vitamin D, because I'm on the track now of the origins, and I don't think we can defer this for 10 minutes. We get into it. The origins, is it possible for human technology in the last 10 or 15 years? Because some people think it sounds like sci-fi. Is it eminently possible, and indeed almost elementary now, that you can in the laboratory put together elements to create a virus? Some people think that's sci-fi, but that's not really sci-fi. You can do it. The only thing that stops you from doing it really is kind of regulations and rules, because it's so dangerous to do that technology that it's generally banned. But otherwise, it's completely within the realms of our technological capability over the last 10 or 15 years. Is that fair to say?
It doesn't even have to be very, very recent technology. So the kind of mutagenesis which drives mutations in a certain direction is at least 2-3 decades old. It's nothing new. And also the gain of function experiments published in the literature, partly by these authors and then partly by their masters in the US, they could do it very easily. You need special tissue cultures, special mice expressing the human ACE2 receptor, for example, and then run the among certain plant circumstances for a long enough period of time. You can direct the outcome towards a certain direction. And there are recombination techniques, so combining different viruses in the same host or same cells, and that's a different technique. And even without direct genetic editing, which is the easiest to spot, and then you are exposed immediately after the first sequencing of a such a kind of weapon, so to say, I think it can be done relatively easily. It's not rocket science anymore. Even I can understand some of these, so it's not so difficult.
Oh, yeah. Such modesty. False modesty, I might add. But yeah, so it's 30-year-old technology. And if people want to view it, there's two approaches. One is to do genetic splicing, where you take pieces you want and you merge it with an existing viral structure or genetic structure. And that one, I think, Gabor, you pointed out, is kind of easy to spot, right? Because it's a step jump.
If it's very modern, then you could theoretically use AI, artificial intelligence, to substitute the human thinking, how a human would do it. Because that's what could be spotted the most easily if it's a human design, because I would do it the same way, put it together the same way. But if you substitute the actual human design and use artificial intelligence to mask these practices, it could be done even with splicing, and then just entering the right parameters into the AI to mask these human spots and human ways of doing it. I think it could be done, but we will probably never know if it was done or not. But it can even be done without those extremely recent and modern practices, I think.
I think that's the key thing. So the splicing technology, which is around for ages, if you did it in a simple way, it would be probably easy to spot. But as you say, if you used AI to design it such that it looked more natural, you could probably cover. But that's still pretty complicated, but entirely doable. People need to realize, first and foremost, it's crucial to realize we have the technology and it's entirely doable. Now, the better way to do it, if I desired to do this, because I'm a smart guy, you're a smart guy, we get together, we want to do this for whatever reason, the smarter way would probably be to evolve it in an accelerated fashion, kind of tilting the direction of evolution, rapid evolution in the laboratory setting, tilting it to end up where we want to be. And that one would leave fewer tracks by its nature, because it would have technically evolved. It might leave some telltale signs, but it's more natural, shall we say, the finished product. So maybe we'll talk a little more about that process of evolving a virus in the direction you desire using these humanized mice and other completely available for decades technology. And I might add in, as you speak, the papers you'll refer to and the evidence and probabilities. I'll add them in on screen afterwards as appropriate.
Yeah, I think mentioning probabilities is a spot on thing to do, because I listed all these things that the spike gained a function or a site where the furin type of proteases can cleave, which the same site expanded serves as a bacterial superantigen. I mean, the probability that you have a furin cleavage site, which when expanded becomes a staphylococcal endotoxin B mimetic, as I mean, mathematically, I'm not as good at mathematics, but it should be what is a stronger word than extremely low? Much stronger than extremely low. So it's unbelievably low.
Yep, and I'd say it sounds like it's infinitesimally low, if you will.
At the same time, it can buy the TLR4 directly. It can buy and aggregate LPS and probably many more I'm not even aware of. So this to come together by chance, I think it's totally unlikely.
Well, yeah, and people need to understand probability, the basics. So if you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of something, and independence and probability is very important. So if you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of something occurring and something else is 1 in 1,000 chance, then together you multiply them. It becomes 1 in 1,000,000 instantly. So 2 improbable things really massively lower probability. So 1 in 1,000 chance of the sun coming out, 1 in 1,000 chance of rain occurring. You know, put them together, it's 1 in 1,000,000 they'll both happen if they're independent events. Now, if the two are intimately connected, it's different. But you're talking about at least 2 or 3 4 highly improbable things, and they've all occurred together suddenly in the evolution of the SARS type or the coronavirus line. So it's enormously improbable from the moment you look at it. But then there are other things to other clues within this virus that point to, you know, it may not have had natural origins. And I think the most striking one, and I'll put it on the screen, is, but you'll have to explain it for me and for the audience, your graph, which shows the affinity or linkage between human cell lines and this virus, and it also shows these mice as being very high on the graph, but there isn't the...
You're talking about the peptide mimicry. That's the proper name. The interesting thing, that was really an eye opener when I first met, almost by coincidence. You know, sometimes I'm deep into some kind of research. It was a immunology research. I was looking into vaccine and vaccine triggered autoimmunity, which is based on the mimicry, the peptide mimicry, and also the glycan mimicry between the virus and the host. The higher the mimicry, the more likely is that the virus can trigger autoimmune responses in a host. And then I was looking at a study, and there was a figure, columns showing the, I think, 6 mer and 7 mer. It means how long peptides are identical, and 6 or 7 peptides are identical between different animal proteins and the viral spike protein. And of course, there was a high similarity with humans because it spent a lot of time in humans, so you expect a certain level of mimicry developing, because then you can then the virus can evade the immune system, avoid early recognition, and so on and so forth. Perhaps it was a bit too high already for humans, but what was really striking, right next to the human column, the high column, the same height column was the mice. Musculus, the Latin name, put under the column, the common mouse. And the mouse, ACE2 receptor, which this virus uses for entry into the cells, is one of the worst receptors for the virus. So mice are absolutely not susceptible to this virus, unless there is a special type of mice, mouse strain used in research, a kind of genetically modified mouse. It's called humanized because the human ACE2 receptor is expressed by the mice. So they on the cell surfaces, they show the human receptor. And of course, the human receptor, the virus can bind very strongly and quickly. So this is a research tool in labs, and it was described, I don't know, 2013, 14, 15, so 6, 7, 8 years ago, how researchers used it in the US. And then this research was moved to China because there was a ban initiated in 2014, I think, in the US, this type of gain of function research in model animals, which try to mimic humans in some ways, was banned in the US. The financing funding was banned, was stopped, and this research was moved to China. But funnily enough, it was still financed by the US, mostly for some kind of circumventing this ban. And I think this one cannot be explained in any other way. How mice have the same level of peptide mimicry to do a viral spike as humans? It's it can only be explained by humanized, genetically modified lab mice. Otherwise, we are not aware of any. I haven't heard of any natural mouse strains having close similarity with human ACE2 receptors. So this is just striking. I mean, what was even more peculiar was the how the authors went about it. But perhaps not the authors, but the reviewers and the editors. It always happens when if you want to publish something, you have to accommodate to the expectations. So they point out that there is extreme level mimicry between humans, mouse, and viral spike, and then add no further comments whatsoever. The only comment is that mathematically, this similarity is extremely improbable. I think that's the only comment what they did. I would love to see the original manuscript submitted and the exchange between the reviewers, editors, and the authors, because that would be really telling what happened. I can imagine that the original manuscript was a little bit different, pointing out that okay, this can have only one explanation because we cannot come up with anything else. And most likely they were silenced altogether.
Yeah, and again, not silenced in a conspiracy theory way, though. I guess, look, conspiracies are part of our modern world everywhere, and
whatever you call it. I mean, it's basic reasoning. You find some figures in a peer-reviewed journal article. And you try to make some sense of it. I mean, you theorize something or hypothesize something because that's what you do when you see unexpected results. If you see unexpected results, you try to explain. And if if there is only one explanation that comes to mind one and after and again, then probably you are not wrong because and I tried to ask several scientists openly on Twitter, for example, and they readily respond to other questions, but not to this one. So yeah, if I ask them, what do you think about this? They don't block me or anything like that. They just remain silent. They are not ready to take an open stance on this. because they have a career in academic and whatever, and probably they are worried that this could be something which puts them in the danger zone or whatever.
Well, it certainly would, and there's no question there that if they acknowledged there was only one reasonable technical explanation, and that was laboratory gain of function, they would immediately, and we know this from the past year, they would be immediately smeared, discredited, and attacked.
Yeah, all over, and putting forward that I wear a tinfoil hat and everything.
No, but it's not about you. You bring the technical, you know, virtuosity, the exceptional technical ability and knowledge in this. But you're not an academic, and you're not going to be attacked. You unfortunately can be ignored. The data can't be ignored. But saying that, the data can be ignored in the mechanisms we've just discussed. Mechanisms are important, right? So the reviewers look at this. They realize to their horror that even though it's just data, nothing to be afraid of, the implications of what the data says are unacceptable to them to publish, because even the reviewers and editors will get attacked if the conclusion points massively towards gain of function, because it answers the question which cannot be allowed to be answered, because the whole colour of this whole thing for the last year utterly inverts if it becomes technically clear that overwhelmingly probable is that it used existing technology that's around for decades, and it looks like that's where it came from. And that explains the four each improbable elements, which you multiply their improbabilities together and you get a huge improbability figure. And then you've got this with the mouse cell line, which makes no sense unless it was part of our clearly established technology. Nothing crazy or sci-fi, but stuff we know we can do. Now, if you add to that the improbability or coincidence, you know, investigators and police are interested in coincidences, of course, and we should be too. The coincidence that this very research is so dangerous by its nature, because it will inevitably lead to a big problem, that the funding was cut and then it's relocated to China and still funded from America. I mean, there's no conspiracy theory here. This is basic logic, right? Occam's razor. And it ends up in Wuhan, I think. Is that where the laboratory ended up going?
Yes.
So
That's another coincidence. But of course, there are only I don't know, four or five BSL, three, four laboratories in China. So the coincidence is not that high, because if there are only five laboratories that can do this gain of function research, it's only 25-30% chance already.
True, but it still divides our ridiculously improbable number by another five. So at some point.
But the bets are 1,000 miles away, again, the bets implicated in hosting these types of viruses are 1,000 miles away from Wuhan, in a completely different southeastern province of China. So that's another coincidence. That how did these bats made it up there? It's weird. Probably by the mouse. I think that by the mice. So the bats bite the mice. In southeast China, the mice migrate to Wuhan and then bite some people at the frozen food market. So that's the most likely explanation what I can come up.
Oh, right. So we take our tiny probability, our infinitesimally small chance of it not being as we perceive from the data, and you got to divide it by another 1,000 or whatever. Pick a number. At this stage, it doesn't matter. How high can you stack coincidences before the whole thing topples over? Well, I think in this case, it's possible. It evolved naturally. Anything's possible. But I think the sci-fi, right, the conspiracy, the outrageously improbable, ridiculous thing that's tinfoily, is to suggest the existing narrative, right, rather than the one we've described. So it's quite amusing.
There is no existing narrative. I mean, even the WHO investigation concluded with something totally banal. I mean, they said that it might have come from frozen food or whatever, which hadn't even been brought up before as a possible origin theory. So it's just, I think it's just a joke. There is no alternative at the moment. No real alternative which could anywhere close to what these the data suggests.
Yeah, well, you know, phrases spring to mind from my corporate career and my career as a brutal realist and a scientific thinker. Phrases like realities don't mention the war, you know, phrases like too big to fail. There's a reality in modern human world, and probably going back thousands of years, that some things, when they're realized, are just literally too big or too awkward to really have become known. It's just too big. And we've seen now for the last year the enormity of this thing, the absolutely disastrous response and interventions which maximized the impact of COVID death, right, alone, maximized that with all the lockdowns and nonsense. And then the impact of the lockdowns on general life, freedoms and economy and the economic determinants of health and everything we hold dear, just beyond enormous negative impacts for nothing. And now we've got this, that if it came out, let's be honest, if it came out that, look, guys, overwhelmingly on five different vectors or points of probability, it's almost certain that this was part of our existing technology and it was, call it a mistake, but it happened. The world cannot digest that this whole thing came out of human technology. I mean, they can't. It's too big to fail. You just can't. You simply cannot have that become a reality, the knowledge. You just can't, because the implications are too horrific. So it's not a conspiracy theory. It's just that if I were a high-level senior manager or VP involved in this whole thing, and I realized, to my horror, what we're describing, I would have to perforce get involved to make sure that this just didn't go out in the press, because I would know, regardless of how I feel about it and how terrible it is and unfortunate if it was a mistake, I would know intuitively it can't become common knowledge. Not because I want to hide it, but because I just know the implications are too messy, and at this point we simply have to bury it. We have no choice. Even if I think it's awful and terrible, and even if I would love the truth to come out, I would be forced in my position to simply make it go away. There is no choice politically. So that's the reality. And you mentioned, I want to segue into something that you touched on there and what you said. Ah, it was the old bats. So that's how this thing started, bats, right, in caves, 1,000 miles away. But how did the bats line up and the other animals in that mimetic graph of points of similarity? And I'll show it again on the screen. How did other animals line up? Because one guy is a real good guy I know in South Africa, or perhaps somewhere else, Leo, looks after apes. It's his life's work. And he said that apes and that species usually get hammered by human flus. And there's a lot of overlap. In ape world, if there's a bad flu going in human world, people have to suit up before they come into the reservations. This is known. But apparently, remarkably, the apes seem to be clear of this one, which is remarkable in itself. So maybe we'll talk about the other animals that don't line up, and including the bats.
Yeah, the bats are actually the bats most closely implicated in potential zoonotic transmission don't really harbor this virus. I mean, this virus cannot infect the bats because their ACE2 is so distant from this one that the bats are not host anymore to this virus. The interesting thing you mentioned, and we can refer to the same graph back again, the peptide mimicry is very low between the SARS-2 spike and other coronavirus spikes, and also non-human primate proteins and other rodent, with the exception of mice and rats. lab, common lab animals. Also the rats, not to the extent as the mice, but rats also show somewhere in between other animals and mice and humans, halfway in between. So that's also a little bit peculiar, probably less experiments in rats than in mice, I would say.
And we will go a little further with this now. Don't want to beat it to death, but I'll ask one question before I go on to the rats. If you had, I don't know, a million researchers who are familiar with this field, and you, impossible in real life, but there are a million completely unbiased researchers, magically, a thought experiment, and you bring them in one by one and just show them the most salient data and say, what's your conclusion? I'm guessing that nearly all the million, if unbiased, with no political or no knowledge, it's a theoretical question, and they know nothing about any implications in real world politics or anything else. Would generally all the million independently look and say, well, yeah, I guess it has to be gain of function? Would that generally be the case?
I think the vast majority would ask for some time to do their own investigation, their own reading research into this, to make sure that I'm not presenting only one half of the findings in a way to confirm my biases. I don't really have biases, but that would be what I would do if I was presented with a new hypothesis with some data. I would look into the other side probably or hopefully refuting information. So I would look for refuting information first, and I think most other researchers would do the same. So have a look at how else this could have materialized. Through natural developments, recombination, or whatever. But again, I think they would eventually come to the conclusion that the probability is not on their side. So, yeah, one or two could happen via complete random recombination between different viruses, one harboring a furin cleavage site, another one not harboring a furin cleavage site, infecting the same immunocompromised person, and then a lot of proliferation, viral reproduction going on, and then in the same cell, the highest recombination always occurs in the spike. So that would be natural. That's not a peculiar thing at all. So the furin cleavage site could be explained, but then you add the bacterial superantigen, which is an extension of the furin cleavage site, then the direct binding of TLR4, then the direct binding of bacterial lipopolysaccharides, then you have a look at the peptide mimicry with the mice. I think when you add up all this together, it boils down to probability, and then this is so minuscule probability that all this happens by natural recombination of very different viruses, that it's not a plausible explanation in my opinion. But I still cannot exclude that there is some explanation which I haven't found yet. So I keep thinking about it, but I couldn't come up with something like that.
And that's fair enough. And you have, in fairness, always held my feet to the fire on all of my hypotheses and beliefs as well, with that Popperian or professor, her doctor, Karl Popper. Look for the black swan that undermines the hypothesis, and there you will find gold. There you will find you may have been incorrect. And you think that way and agonize like I do. So whenever everything fits too well, and I think this fits with what I expected as well, confirmation bias, be extremely careful. Look for the black swan against my own hypothesis, because that's the only way you will get to scientific truth, is to constantly challenge your own hypothesis. So we're well embedded in that. But let's, just to finish the thought experiment with these million theoretical guys, let's say that you are able to assure them, for the purposes of the theoretical question, that what they see is largely what they're going to find if they research. given that and assuming that, what would they say? And I suppose in that case, you'd have all but one or two kind of cranks acknowledging, well, based on that data, given that it's pretty complete, of course, you would have to say it goes through the human design process, you would think. Yeah.
Then I think we can continue to speculate about the consequences. If you accept that there is a chance, at least, there is a good chance that the virus, you said the right way, came out, because it either leaked technically, it either leaked or was released. There are two options then. I'm not saying, because there is absolutely no information about this, but if you think about lab origins, then the next step is considering leak or release. And of course, the first thing one should consider is why this type of virus? Why directing the evolution of a virus in this direction? And if you have a look at the outcome, it's a virus which can produce disturbance. It's not a killer virus. I think the two of us could design a much better killer virus in a lab. So this is not an ultimate biological weapon to kill the highest number of enemies at all. This is a virus which, if it was designed, to create disturbance. What kind of disturbance? And then is it a coincidence that the virus kind of preys on old and ill people? And what kind of enemy it could have been designed against? So if you would be just based on the outcomes, the elderly, the metabolically challenged people fall victim to this virus. How a kind of enemy looks like, and how my own homeland looks like, it should be different from the perspective of spread and harm and disturbance done. And you clearly see that those populations with higher age, and especially age combined with obesity, metabolic diseases, come out the worst from this pandemic. So it's kind of attacking populations with high rates of obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and also having a lot of old people within the society. So that's my speculation, completely speculation.
Yeah, fair enough, and it is speculation. It's a reality and a fact that that's the case, but then tying it to intents is speculation. And of course, the accidental or the intended kind of intentional release will never be known. But it kind of also just nicely fits. If we add one more thing, that the eastern areas generally will have more T-cell cross immunity to prior SARS. You know, we're assuming from many papers that there is an advantage there in immune speed of reaction and mitigation of severe impacts by having a more history with the prior SARS. If you add them together, it kind of explains my world diagram, which for me screams to me as an engineer. If you draw, and I'll show it on the screen, if you draw a map of the world, you've got huge, vast regions typified generally by what you said, more older, more metabolic disease, more immunocompromised, more autoimmune from bad foods, all that stuff. Huge areas typified by that, and also largely typified by having less exposure to prior SARS, perhaps. But those vast regions of billions of people, regardless of lockdowns or masks, there's a 30 times greater effective impact in terms of ICU and mortality. 30 times.
Yeah, I saw that many Asia-Pacific countries implemented different strategies, different mitigation strategies. Japan is not the same as Taiwan or Vietnam or India or Australia. Very different strategies, yet the outcomes are very similar. And I think that cannot be explained by the interventions themselves, because in my view, only one thing can explain such differences in outcomes is and it's immunity. What kind of immunity, whether it's pre-existing or it's just lower levels of metabolic diseases, different demographics, much lower levels of elderly, or a combination of these, or pre-existing immunity for whatever reason, you mentioned a few. It could be unnoticed SARS-like coronaviruses. If there was a prior virus spread, for example, which didn't cause severe disease, only cold, for example, with similar but not identical antigens, especially not the antigens what we are measuring with the PCR, for example, or with the antibodies. It's plausible, but you don't even see the seroprevalence studies from these countries. I haven't seen a nationwide representative seroprevalence study from New Zealand, for example, or from Japan or from Taiwan or from China. China would be the most straightforward, but nobody's doing it. Why? No. It's very weird, because that's the information you could base some conclusions on. That if there is really higher pre-existing immunity or now existing immunity to the same or very similar virus, which actually reacts or shows up in antibody tests, it cannot be said. It cannot be known at all, because there are no studies looking into this. It's weird.
It's truly shocking that New Zealand, there are no T cell studies to show history of SARS-CoV-2 exposure, or indeed what we're describing, cross immunity. And I'm going to come back to, and I don't want to forget it, back to that 30 times difference of impact to drive it home to the listener. But I must mention, there's one study, and it's the study I would have done as a problem solver back in March, April, and done all ever since. And the study is to take several hundred random people and repeatedly do antibody tests every 2 weeks. And then you would see the tempo of the problem and answer the questions we're asking. And they did it in Tokyo. They took around 400 people in 13 districts of Tokyo where there was no lockdowns, but there was kind of mask stuff. And they measured their antibody status repeatedly every 2 weeks. And the PCR went up in Tokyo's surge in these people and down again, tailed off as expected. Went up to 30%+ or whatever. And their antibody tests, nearly 50% of this sample group got up to positive antibody for SARS-CoV-2. And then they began to decline. So in other words, Tokyo, this is unquestionable, did not stop the spread. They actually got infected in huge quantities. But the impact level in ICU and death was just very small. So it kind of answers our question. And isn't it incredible that there was only one such study really done, the most important study of all, serial antibody tracking to see the actual tempo of the problem. So there's that, and I'll put that up on the screen. But the other thing is to return to the example, what we've got from pure logic, Popperian logic, whatever. And actually, people just need to think about this, really. So imagine hypothetically, I said to you that there's a surge in skin cancer, right? But wearing black clothes all over can greatly reduce it, okay? That's the analogy for lockdowns and masks. But then you turned around to me and showed me a map of the world and said, hold on a minute. Okay, so the skin cancer is kind of going up everywhere, but the areas, right, Europe and North America and other areas with billions of people where they're doing most black clothes wearing, right, they've got 30 times the rate of the skin cancer problem And you're telling me the black clothes are the big thing to help lower it? And the regions that are wearing black clothes intermittently, and some of them not really at all, are broadly, with billions of people, around 30 times less skin cancer. So that absolutely disproves, resoundingly, that the black clothes are protecting you from skin cancer. And that's the analogy for lockdowns and masks. I mean, we have Sweden, we have Florida, and we have all the other country examples, evidence that kind of disproves the lockdown mask effectiveness. That's true. But also at a global scale, the people with the most lockdowns, the most masks, draconian by law, all over, have around 30 times the problem, right? So anyway, it's just, I'm pulling my hair out at this stage, even though I don't have any. But there we are, here we are.
Yeah, it's all about properly working immunity, I think. It's all the factors we mentioned, vitamin D and others, channel into this perfectly. So it's not a immune booster per se. It's a immune enabler or balancer. So if you have it, naturally you should have it because you are out in the sun. We have evolved to be out in the sun, and then in the northern or really southern regions, we can store in our fat tissues the vitamin D. So it's coming out during the winter, but you still become depleted by the time of February or early March when the sun is strong enough again in these areas. By the way, next weekend, if the weather is nice, I will try my first sun bath this year, because it should be the time. That's the threshold when it's high up enough. So I encourage everybody to do that as soon as he can. Until that, take supplements or buy a Sperti lamp or a UV lamp. Or whatever, but anything is better than just leaving it up for others, for politicians or scientists to solve my own problem, because my immunity is my own problem. So I wouldn't expect others to solve my own problem all the time, and expect others to hide because I failed to lose 10 kilograms or 25 pounds of weight in 1 year. Already, we are approaching 1 year of the outbreak, the international outbreak, end of February. Tomorrow is March. So I think in 1 year, you can lose 30 kilos if you want, or 50 or whatever excess you have, 100 pounds. And if you haven't done it, it's not a problem of the politicians or scientists or medical doctors. It's your own problem. So take your health into your own hands. That's my primary advice.
Excellent. Now, that's a great way to draw to a close, but we're going to come back and talk more about this and maybe talk more about vitamin D, perhaps not today, but there's already been a lot said about it. And one thing I'll say as well is the Sperti lamp is very expensive. It's an excellent FDA approved and human tested UV lamp, but it's very expensive, and a workaround my wife actually got from a guy in Canada, a super smart guy in keto and low carb, and he figured out reptile lamps. So you can buy 160 watt reptile lamps, which are the full sun spectrum with UV and everything in infrared, perfect lamps to generate this. And they use them for reptiles because reptiles drop their vitamin D, their bones get brittle and they just fall apart. But you can buy them for around €45 each, get a few into an array, and have yourself a pretty super cheap, alternative when the sun isn't available, or if you rather get it naturally than by taking pills, you can do something like that. So just a tip there, entirely up to the individual, of course. It's not approved or regulated for that use, but most people now are getting pretty smart in the circles we move in to look at the UV density and look at a few of the numbers and use anything like that appropriately. So great stuff, Gabor. And I might split this one up actually into the origins and all the other content we talked about, because I think the origins really is a self-standing discussion. So I might do that afterwards, and you can send me all the papers to feature on the screen. So super duper, as always, fantastic to talk to you. Any last thoughts, or will we leave it with the vitamin D thought and the lamp, like you said?
I think that's good enough to close up the discussion, really.
Great stuff. We'll be back, though.
Thanks again for having me.
No, thank you, Gabor. The best content possible, with the best science and the best approaches and mechanisms.
Bye-bye.
There you have it, guys. And it's kind of funny to think in 2020, and certainly in early 21, we knew the answer and we got it out there, even if it was censored. But as always, to get the actual data and correct integration of data and science out there to explain what's going on in the world and to counter, of course, the torrent, the fire hose of misinformation coming from legacy media, hopefully people can continue to support me through Patreon or PayPal or any other means. And a huge thanks to those who are already doing so, because for the future of our children and grandchildren, it's very important that we actually get truth and science out there. And again, counter that media nonsense that comes from some very reprobate individuals up top. Thank you.